600 episodes. I'm Josh Landy.
And I'm Jeremy Sable. Thank you for listening.
And thank you for thinking.
When what you're listening to gets to be a bit too much, it's good to go back to where it all began, the radio. Tune in to WHFR.FM for relaxing live shows, hosts you can connect with, and alternative variety music that you won't be able to get enough of. That's WHFR.FM at 89.3. WHFR Dearborn. We're making waves, so dial in and catch them.
Take charge of your college experience. The HFC Student Activities Office can help you connect with or start a club, plan and promote events or fundraisers, or even find volunteer opportunities in our community. The HFC Student Activities Office operates 8 a.m. to 5 p.m., Monday through Thursday in the fall and winter semesters, and 8 a.m. to 5 p.m., Monday through Thursday in the summer semester. You can find the HFC Student Activities Office on campus in the M Building or call 313-845-9865. That's 313-845-9865.
This is WHFR Dearborn. Good afternoon. Thank you for listening and welcome to the WHFR Journal. Susan McGraw with you on this Friday, the 7th of March, 2025, as we welcome in March as the month of renewal and, well, spring in a couple of weeks. We are also excited to start a conversation about women's history as we celebrate Women's History Month this entire month here at WHFR. We are looking forward to sharing some special programming. Do note that for next week's show, we're going to continue our Counselor Connection series. Licensed professional counselor Amy Ducklow will be joining us for a segment, and we'll do another one of those the second Friday in the month of April. But looking forward to airing Amy's presentation next week. We also have some exciting opportunities to sort of get with nature and the universe, if you will. The Hammond Planetarium here at Henry Ford College is offering a variety of shows for you to connect with, enjoy, and really take advantage of for free. We say explore the universe through these free Hammond Planetarium shows here at Henry Ford College. If you've not been to the Hammond Planetarium, it is super cool. It's upgraded, it is state-of-the-art, and it really is a fascinating exploration of space, things that you can't see with the naked eye, or you don't know what you're looking at when you do see it with the naked eye. We've got a lot of interesting space and sky anomalies coming up, a blood moon coming up, I think, in another week or so. Maybe you caught that, you know, eclipse from last April, but certainly things going on every single day. And the planetarium is providing a number of opportunities for you to check things out. So if you want to get involved in joining for a show at the Hammond Planetarium, it is, as most planetariums are, a small space designed to be intimate and dark and well, cozy, so that when the lights go on in the sky, you can really, really see what you're supposed to. The planetarium is here on the campus of Henry Ford College in the Science Building. That's Building J here on the main campus on Evergreen Road in Dearborn. This is open to everyone, not just students. This is open to the community. And the next couple of shows we want to talk about actually are literally right around the corner. Friday, March 14th, 7:30 to 8:30 p.m., and then Wednesday, March 19th, 7:30 to 8:30 p.m. There will be shows in April, May, and June as well, but these are the ones that are right around the corner. So we really would love you to be able to reserve your seat, and you do have to register in advance, again, because these absolutely sell out, but it's not too late to jump in. On Friday, March 14th, the show is called How It's Really Made, a planetarium presentation, how it's really made. Super interesting. And the Wednesday show, March 19th, is called Nothing Gold Can Stay. That is the spring seasonal show. That is, I think it's quite outstanding. You'll actually hear my voice in a little bit of that show as well. It was my honor to participate in that. So lots of things going on with the Hammond Planetarium. And if you'd like more information, do note that you can simply go to the website. It is planetarium at hfcc.edu if you'd like to contact directly, or just go to hfcc.edu and search Hammond Planetarium, and you will get the information. For safety reasons, they do not admit you once the doors are closed. So, little tip, arrive 15 minutes early. Again, registration is required, but there's an occasional opportunity for some open seating. but they do typically tend to sell out. And the director of the planetarium and astronomy instructor, Jesse Mason, shares that he is pleased to not only bring the Dearborn community these shows, but also two presentations that are going to be a big hit to space fans all the way around. So there's an opportunity to, again, check out something new, free and open to the public. Again, email at planetarium@hfcc.edu or just go to our website, hfcc.edu, and search planetarium. Again, shows coming up on March 14th and March 19th. Okay, in addition, we have other opportunities to celebrate things here at HFC. And another aspect that we want to talk about, which is forthcoming, is an opportunity to learn more about the STEM classes and the STEM programs here at HFC. There's a big event coming up next month, and we're going to tell you a little bit about that as we move on throughout this month of March as well. So if you're interested in sports, Henry Ford College has opportunities for you to come and actually cheer on your favorite community college here in Dearborn and our wonderful Hawks. So if you'd like to learn more, check out athletics at hfcc.edu. Well, today's program is presented to us from Public Radio Exchange, PRX, and the title is called The Suffragist in the Basement. This was formatted for radio from a monumental podcast. The podcast is called Monumental, and it explores different monuments throughout these United States. And this one is, I think, pretty relevant for women and women's history. And the description reads, when it comes to women and monuments in the United States, we seem to prefer mythical or allegorical women. Think like a lady in robes holding the scales of justice in front of a courthouse. But truly, it's actually rare to see real women being honored for their actual accomplishments with monuments. But for decades, there was one statue in Wyoming that was an exception. Wyoming, by the way, is known as the Equality State because it was the first state in the nation to pass women's suffrage. And it recognized that history with a statue of Wyoming's first justice of the peace and suffragist, Esther Hobart Morris, which stood at the state capitol building for 60 years. But today, that statue of Morris now lives underground in the capitol basement. In this program, in this episode of Monumental, the host will look at what the story of this one monument could actually be revealing about how women are basically mythologized and, frankly, erased.
This is a special presentation of Monumental, a series from PRX. I'm your host, Ashley C. Ford. Monuments can provoke intractable conflicts about historic injustice, about grief, about who our heroes are. Across the country, communities have been re-examining the plaques in their parks and the sculptures in their streets, reconsidering the messages these monuments send. Taking monuments down or giving them pride of place says who we are and what matters.
Women count. Equal say, equal rights, and we can't let that go.
In Wyoming, the Equality State, how does the treatment of a suffragist monument reflect the status of women there now? What difference can a memorial make in this monumental task of forging a new American identity, one that includes all of us? That's coming up on this hour of Monumental from PRX. When I was growing up in Fort Wayne, Indiana, and was maybe 17, I spent a lot of time with three women. Actually, statues of three women. The Hamiltons. One sister was a physician, the other a scholar, and their cousin a social worker. A plaque spelled out how they'd each had a string of accomplishments. I must have read that plaque dozens of times, and looking back, I realized how much it expanded my sense of what I could accomplish, which is part of the work I hope monuments can do.
You could build 100,000 monuments tomorrow to women. And if doing that doesn't change the fact that the Dobbs decision came down, if doing that isn't part of building towards not having a hand-picked judge in Texas strip the right to medical abortion to every pregnant person in this country, then it's not actually a monument. It's not actually doing the work that building a monument does.
That's Sue Mobley, Director of Research at Monument Lab.
the work that a monument does is consolidating and stamping the act of defining that society, defining the bounds of who's in and who's out. It is about power.
In 2021, Sue Mobley and Monument Lab conducted an audit of monuments across the country. Of the top 50 people most commonly commemorated, only three were women who actually existed. We seem to prefer mythical or allegorical women. Think a lady in robes holding the scales of justice in front of a courthouse. I see now how rare it was for me to have the Hamilton sisters to look up to. Real women being honored for what they actually did in the world. All of which sets the stage for the story you're about to hear. This is Monumental, a series from PRX. I'm your host, Ashley C. Ford. Wyoming is known as the Equality State because it was the first in the nation to pass women's suffrage. And for decades, it's proudly recognized that history with a statue of Esther Hobart Morris, a justice of the peace and a vocal participant in the women's suffrage movement. But that statue is no longer standing in front of the Wyoming State Capitol. Producer Irina Zhuroff examines what that says about the status of women in Wyoming.
On the third floor of the Wyoming Capitol in Cheyenne, there are four sculptures arranged under the building's golden cupola. Their patina gives them an aged look, but they were only commissioned in 2018. They're called the Four Sisters, and Tony Ross, a retired legislator, loves them. They're kind of his legacy.
Pretty cool stuff.
So how do you feel standing in front of them?
Well, I'm trying to be really cool.
The first sister is Truth, lighting the way with a lamp. Then Justice, who holds the Wyoming Constitution. Next is Courage, hand-gripped around the serpent's neck. Finally is Hope, a golden wreath in each hand.
I'm welling up right now.
Ross served as a state representative here, then senator, and finally a Senate president. His biggest project in that position was overseeing an immense Capitol renovation. It cost more than $300 million, and starting in 2015, took 4 years.
I was here every day. I looked through every swatch of carpeting to painting to everything.
The four statues we're looking at now were the project's finale. They fill four niches in the building's rotunda that have stood empty since the Capitol's construction in 1888. Their bodies are draped in gauzy fabric, belly buttons shining through. The women look self-assured, muscular, also feminine. Ross says they embody the state's highest principles.
The reason it was allegorical was to represent values of the people of the state of Wyoming are, then and now. And that doesn't necessarily equate to just an individual. We all have our own flaws.
Instead, they're idealized figures embodying ideals.
They are absolutely fabulous.
You can say hope, courage, justice, but that's an intangible.
This is Peg Osland. She's a Wyoming native, 70 years old, and she doesn't love the allegorical statues as much as Tony Ross does.
It takes a human being who had a story to tell. These don't have stories to tell. It's just a feel-good, like a fantasy.
Austin grew up in the land in Wyoming, and the more she looked at the sisters, the more out of place they seemed to her. For her, the aesthetics didn't fit the state's founding or history.
You got rattlesnakes. Out at our ranch, we had mountain lions. You got bears. You got bandits. You know, a token of bare feet and themes, that wouldn't work with that. That was grit. That was dust. That was bathrooms on the side of the road, broken down carriages.
Their different opinions get at this tension around female figures and monuments. They're usually allegorical. Real women and their accomplishments are represented so rarely. Lately, though, people have been demanding more representation of important women. Wyoming actually did have a prominent statue of a real woman at the Capitol. It's a big reason Ostlin has such strong feelings about the Four Sisters. Because around the time they were commissioned, that statue of a woman named Esther Hobart Morris disappeared from where she stood, right in front of the Capitol.
There's a group of us that are walkers. So when she was outside, you'd talk to her in the morning. I'd ask her for a lot of strength, courage.
The statue was 8 feet tall, plus a pedestal. In her hand, she held what looked like a bouquet of flowers.
I would have been about 10 when she was put out front here. And that's how I just remember her, is just this powerful figure of a woman.
Esther Hobart Morris was a suffragist who moved to Wyoming in 1869. By most accounts, she was instrumental in the passage of Wyoming's suffrage law that same year. It was the first such law in the whole country, signed 50 years before the 19th Amendment enfranchised all American women. Then, Morris herself was appointed the first female justice of the peace. Wyoming became known as the Equality State.
We were the first government in the world, to grant women the right to vote. And so coming from a rural area, that really had an impact on me.
One small example, in high school, Ostlin ran to be the first woman student body president. She channeled Esther in her pamphlets.
It was, you know, dear everybody, these little letters, Peg is a girl, so is Esther Hobart Morris.
She won. In 2015, when the Capitol renovation started, Ostlin watched through a fence as workers packed the statue into a wood crate and removed her. A crane needed to park in her spot. Plus, Esther needed some restoration of her own. She'd been hit by a car twice and had been battered by the Wyoming weather for more than half a century. In 2019, the 150th anniversary of women getting the vote in Wyoming, the Capitol reopened to great fanfare.
Wyoming citizens, this is your house. This is where your business is done.
Ostlin went to look for Esther, but Esther never reappeared outside.
Like, where is she? It's just astounding to me. That magnificent, forward-looking statue is gone.
When the renovation started, in addition to doing necessary structural work, the driving ethos was to restore the building to historic accuracy. Tony Ross again.
We wanted to make sure that we returned it back to the way it should be.
Workers uncovered glass skylights, repainted Trompe l'oeil designs on the walls, restored paint colors, chandeliers, and art. Esther and another statue that stood outside of a 19th century leader of the Eastern Shoshone tribe, Chief Washakie, weren't original to the building, but they'd been there a while. Everyone assumed they'd just go back to their spots once work wrapped up. But there was this underground connector between the Capitol and another government building that became more important as the renovation dragged on. It had meeting rooms, an auditorium, skylights that framed the Capitol's restored dome. And Ross says this question came up about the statues.
There was debate over whether or not they should go back out in front or not.
Legislators reasoned that in this expanded basement space, school groups could gather around the statues without standing in the frigid Wyoming weather. Esther and Chief Washakie could have a richer interpretive life indoors. The committee voted to move them. It didn't seem like a big deal. But when Peg Ostlin and others realized what happened, it was.
I think it was one sort of shock. Because they went to every damn detail to restore history around here. How could you overlook something that had been in front of the Capitol for 60 years? That's a pretty long time, 60 years.
As workers lifted the four sisters to a golden dome and Esther descended underground, these statues became inextricably linked. For Aslan, the statues and their placement in the Capitol said a lot about the state's commitment to its women. The new statues felt hypothetical, promising nothing specific. Esther, on the other hand, had been a real woman who stood for Wyoming's radical history of suffrage and women's contributions, for women's equality. To Osland, her move felt like a demotion, one reflected in other facets of Wyoming life.
I think we're regressing.
Wyoming has the highest wage gap in the nation. It's among the worst for the proportion of women serving in state legislatures. Maternal mortality rates are higher than average. Participation by women in business is lower than average. The list goes on. In 2022, U.S. News & World Report ranked Wyoming number 45 out of 50 for best states for gender equality.
There's something wrong with that picture.
And that statue of Esther? To Aslan, she was a reminder of the state's promises and potential, of the story it told about itself to the world. We are the equality state. The statue had a message Wyomingites needed to hear.
Women count. Women count. They don't just take a back seat to their husbands, that they have equal say. Equal say, equal rights. And we can't let that go. We cannot let our guard down. We can't get complacent about it.
But as I dug deeper into the statue and the story behind it, I found that simple story was not so simple. The equality state was founded on some problematic principles, and even the statue itself has some baggage around what it means to be a woman in the West. But before we explore all that, let's start with the woman in the monument herself, Esther Hobart Morris. Esther Hobart Morris is born in upstate New York in 1814. She's part of a large family and a politically engaged community.
There's a whole religious revival movement happening. There's a lot of abolition and temperance activity happening. So she's kind of growing up in that climate.
This is Jennifer Helton. She's from Wyoming, though now she's an assistant professor of history at Ohlone College in California. She studies women's suffrage in the West. There are differing accounts of ages, but according to Helton, Esther's mother passes away when she's about 12. Her father dies when she's 19.
And so what you would expect is that a young woman, kind of without a lot of economic resources, at that point would probably get married and start a family of her own.
Esther puts that off. She starts a millinery business, making women's hats. For a while, she's on her own. Eventually, she does marry, at what would have been considered an advanced age for that time, 27. She has a son, but her husband soon dies too.
So then she's left alone with an infant child to raise by herself.
These hardships in her life, the death of her parents and then her husband, are formative, but maybe not in the ways you think.
So one of the things that comes across in Esther's letters that I think is really interesting is she writes about how because her father died and because her husband died, she didn't have a man telling her what to do. And so she had a lot of freedom in terms of figuring out where she was going to live and how she was going to raise her kids. And she had a lot of more opportunity to kind of make decisions than a lot of women did. And she liked it.
In this letter to her niece, she writes about her oldest son, Archie.
I have acted more independent with Archie than I could have done if his father had been living, and it has given me strength. And no doubt that is what made me strong in early life. I had no parent to control, or what is worse, to do just enough to keep me from doing for myself.
After her first husband's death, she packs up and moves to Illinois, where he owns some land. She marries again, has three more kids, but then more tragedy. One of her sons dies and her husband begins a downward spiral. He drinks a lot and their marriage becomes tense. Leaving it isn't much of an option in those times, but Esther does her own thing in the confines of a hard marriage. She's interested in radical causes. She reads suffragist literature, has close relationships with other suffragists. She attends abolitionist lectures and she writes a lot of letters, especially to nieces she's close with, also suffragists, like this excerpt from 1864, at the height of the Civil War.
I sometimes think I feel a little like the Democrats, that I had no hand in making this war, and that I shall not be drafted.
And as she's writing her letters during the Civil War, she's getting grouchier and grouchier about the fact that the world has just, you know, is burning down, and here she has to put up with it, but she didn't have any voice in creating this mess. And so she clearly is expressing that, you know, if she was able to vote, like, she would at least have some kind of say, but she doesn't.
And then in 1868, an article appears in the Chicago Tribune that changes the course of her life. It's about a new gold rush. In 1867, some soldiers on leave found a gold vein in the rocks around an important emigration route in what is now central Wyoming. They showed off the gold, and news of their find got into the Chicago paper. Esther's husband and her oldest son are instantly interested. They pack their bags and head out. 1 year later, Esther follows them.
When we come back, Esther Hobart Morris comes into her own in South Pass City. That's next on Monumental from PRX. Back in a moment. This is Monumental from PRX. I'm your host, Ashley C. Ford. Let's continue our story.
On an August morning, I visited the old mining town called South Pass City. I wanted to see where Esther made history. By car, it's about 40 minutes from the nearest town, Lander. Turned off the asphalt road.
And it's another 2 miles to South Pass City on this bumpy gravel road.
I rattled along for a few minutes, looking for signs of a town, and saw none.
Oh, wow. It's really pretty.
The plains were green with sage and yellow with flowers. The sky, immense. Finally, I spotted an old mineral processing facility. And a little further,
here I am, South Pass City Historic Site.
These days, 5 people live here full time. One of them is Joe Ellis, the superintendent of the historic site. That's what he calls it. He doesn't like the term ghost town.
There's always somebody living here. And in different time periods, it was a fairly substantial community.
In the late 1800s, there were some 300 buildings, 2,500 people.
You know, it was probably a busy place, probably filthy too.
3 stamp mills to crush and process ore operated just above town.
They're incredibly noisy. Just this relentless beating sound.
There were horses, wood fires.
You know, there were a lot of saloons.
14 saloons, to be exact. So a lot of chaos, but also a bit of luxury.
You could get anything. Oysters, you could order off of the Union Pacific and they'd be here within 3 to 4 days.
Oysters? You can barely get oysters in Wyoming today.
Yeah. The saloons served incredible amounts of champagne because it was the drink of the day.
The social makeup of the town included a small black population, a small Chinese population, the white settlers, and Native American tribes on the settlement's periphery. In 1858, men outnumbered women 5 to 1. So while settlers brought their strict social mores around race and gender,
a lot of the normal lines would have been blurred. The frontier town, it's a necessity. You don't have enough population to do all of the roles in the classic women's work and men's work. You needed a lot of people to operate a lot of saloons, and that wasn't necessarily always going to be a man.
So yes, women owned the saloons too, but they weren't allowed to drink in them. It was an expanded, yet still restrained kind of freedom. The political atmosphere was also unique. Wyoming only became a state in 1890, so back then the area was a territory, and a remote one at that. But the settlers who came brought a hopefulness to South Pass City and the territory beyond. A hopefulness to strike it rich, yes, but also to create something. The idea of starting fresh and building an idealized place was appealing to people just starting to reckon with the Civil War.
There are people who are coming west with some kind of vision. We've kind of been through this very traumatic experience, and now we're going to build a new country. You know, we've abolished slavery, and it's going to be a new world.
This is suffrage historian Jennifer Helton again. Helton says people are arriving with pretty distinct visions for this new world. The progressives of the time are the Republicans. Their policies towards Native Americans in Wyoming, which include crowding warring tribes onto a newly created reservation, are catastrophic. But for settlers, they envision a more equal society. The conservatives of the time are the Democrats, mostly from the South. Many are white supremacists who want to reestablish some semblance of the social order they thought they lost in the Civil War. Between the two main parties, there's a tension, but also a truce grounded in optimism. So this is the climate in South Pass City when Esther Hobart Morris arrives in 1869. She's 55 at this point, self-assured in her values, a dominating presence and strong personality. And though her family comes seeking financial opportunity, she's also likely aware that the West could present other opportunities too. Like, says Jennifer Helton, around an issue that's very dear to her heart, women's suffrage.
There was a general sense of, you know, in the East, we have all these vested interests, and those legislatures have been around a long time. They're kind of hidebound, doing things the way they've always been doing them. So if we're going to have a breakthrough, it's more likely to happen in the West.
Esther brings suffragist literature along. Suffragist friends come to visit her. And soon, she starts meeting locals, too. One important friendship she develops is with a couple, William and Julia Bright. Julia also wants to vote. William is a Democrat from Virginia, and he's running to be a legislator for South Pass City. Esther starts to talk to the Brights about suffrage. Then, she reaches out more. Esther, one story goes, holds a gathering.
Some people say it was a dinner party. Some people say it was a tea party.
She invites all the local candidates for the legislature, including William Bright.
In an era when women did not have political power and you wanted to shape the course of political events, what you had to do was talk to the men who were in power.
She sits these men down
and asks them all to support suffrage.
This party story is central to Esther's legend today. True or not, it's come to represent her work to win key people to this cause. William Bright himself gives her credit for educating him. Decades later, in 1902, in a speech, he'll say, quote, "Mrs. Esther Morris had loaded me down with women's suffrage before I went to the legislature. I had never thought much about it before knowing her." That September, in 1869, William Bright wins his seat. By October, he's in Cheyenne for Wyoming's first territorial legislative session. And something strange happens. Even though women's rights are not a priority for Democrats nationally, and all of the legislators in that first session are conservatives from the Democratic Party, the lawmakers from South Pass City start sponsoring a bunch of bills related to women's rights.
Divorce laws, inheritance laws, and equal pay law, saying that women teachers have to be paid the same as men.
And these bills make it through the legislature pretty quickly.
And then towards the end of the session, William Bright proposes the suffrage bill. And at that point, even the other guys from South Pass are like, whoa, that might be a bridge too far. Are you sure?
Remember, the legislators are all conservative Democrats, all men. In theory, they shouldn't be interested in this bill, but they are. Helton says some of the men, like William Bright, have a genuine belief in suffrage. They're also motivated by racism. Bright thinks that enfranchising women could help secure white supremacy in the territory and keep the Democrats in power. The thinking goes, white female voters will cancel out black voters, men and women.
So it's a mixture of what today we might call progressive motives towards equality and racist motives that are against equality.
There's some resistance to the bill, but it does make it through both chambers. It ends up on the desk of the progressive Republican governor, John Campbell.
And so he kind of sits on it basically until the last minute. And then he decides, we're going to do it. He signs it.
That night, the story goes, in the bars of Cheyenne, men recite a toast. To the ladies, once our superiors, now our equals. It's December 10th, 1869, and all of a sudden, Wyoming women can vote. And not just that, they can hold office, too.
That basically puts women on the exact same political plane as men. So it's actually quite radical.
2 months after the governor signs the bill granting suffrage in 1869, Esther Hobart Morris is appointed Justice of the Peace in South Pass City. The position as a minor judge does not require specific credentials. Usually it was held by a prominent man in town. Esther is the first woman to ever hold this public office. Helton says this may have been a nod to how involved she was with suffrage.
I think that appointing Esther Morris was kind of a Republican statement of, okay, now we've got suffrage, we're going to enforce it, and we're going to put this woman in charge. And Esther Morris was a no-nonsense kind of woman.
In a letter to her niece soon after her appointment, Esther writes,
"If it does belong to man to take care of women, I have ever been engaged in the men's work, so will be nothing new to me. The Democrats passed the bill, and the Republicans made appointments, so that some in both parties are for it, it seems. In both parties accept it. I shall take things as they come, even if I should be made President of the United States, but really do have too much to do things well."
She signs the letter Mrs. and Justice E. Morris.
A lot of her cases that she tried were public drunkenness.
This is Joe Ellis again, superintendent of the South Pass City Historic Site. He says she tried tax issues, legal disputes between individuals, physical altercations, that kind of thing. None of her rulings were ever overturned.
It's probably a testimony that there wasn't a massive controversy about her. That's probably a testimony to how good of a judge she was, as she was very based in the law.
Her historic role makes her famous nationally. And she gets invited to various suffrage meetings and conventions. In a public letter responding to one such invitation, she reflects on her role in pushing forward equality for women.
"Circumstances have transpired to make my position as Justice of the Peace a test of women's ability to hold public office. And I feel that my work has been satisfactory, although I have often regretted I was not better qualified to fill the position. Like all pioneers, I have labored more in faith and hope. And in performing all these duties, I do not know as I have neglected my family any more than in ordinary shopping. And I must admit that I have been better paid for the services rendered than for any I have ever performed."
Esther loves getting paid for her work, by the way. It provides her the independence she always craved, and which was so novel for women at the time. She does this job for 9 months. On the last day of her tenure, Esther's son writes to his cousin.
"It is surprising to note how public sentiment has changed in this little community in regard to women voting. You hear no open sneering about it as at first, and many have become open and declared advocates."
In 1872, Esther leaves her husband. She leaves South Pass City. She tries out a couple of other places, but settles in Cheyenne. She dies there in 1902 at 87 years old.
When we come back, Esther Hobart Morris's story takes on a life of its own. That's next on Monumental from PRX. Back in a moment. This is Monumental from PRX. I'm your host, Ashley C. Ford. Let's get back to our story.
Even before Esther Hobart Morris dies in 1902, Early Wyoming historians are already penning the story of suffrage in the state.
So when they're writing up the story of women's suffrage, they give Esther Morris a central role, and they celebrate her as the mother of women's suffrage.
Historian Jennifer Helton says most of these early historians are women. It's a place of opportunity for people who can't break into the more rigid and connected legacy institutions in the East.
And so there's a lot of educated women professionals who come West, and they become things like professors and doctors and lawyers because they can't do that in other parts of the country.
And the way these historians tell it, Esther isn't just important to suffrage, and suffrage isn't just important to women. They're both fundamental to the state story. Suffrage, and Esther specifically, are at the center of the narrative Wyoming constructs about itself in the late 1800s and first decades of the 1900s.
It is an important part of Wyoming's identity and its history, and it's how Wyoming explains itself to the world.
In the 1950s, a U.S. senator for Wyoming suggests the state build a monument to Esther to go in the National Statuary Hall in Washington, D.C. Each state is allowed two statues there to represent its people. In a referendum, Wyomingites agree this is a good idea. Ednis Kimball Wilkins, who serves in the state's House of Representatives at the time, along with one other woman, introduces a bill to commission the statue. In the House, it passes without a hitch.
But over in the Senate, it was a different picture.
This is Kimball Wilkins in an interview in 1960. She says a senator proposes Chief Washakie instead. Then other senators start proposing kind of ridiculous alternatives. They propose a train robber and a humorist. It devolves pretty quickly.
They suggested the bucking bronco. Oh, and then someone wanted to put the Esther Morris on top of the bucking bronco. Well, the final thing was that one of the men said, well, is this to be a full-length statue or just a bust? And then they talked about Esther's bust, and the result right then was that the statue was laughed to death.
The next day, though, the senator who originally proposed Chief Washakie...
Well, he said, in fact, he had had telegrams all night and telephone calls and people knocking on his door, and he wanted them to take the women off his back.
He caves to public pressure. He puts the bill before the Senate once again, and it passes almost unanimously. To raise the $30,000 needed for the sculpture, the Esther Morris Memorial Commission launches a statewide fundraising effort. Peg Oslin, the Wyoming native who used to talk to the Esther statue, says people chip in what they can.
Beauty shops, school kids, church organizations, newspapers, the whole gamut.
There's a statement of contributions that lists reams of donors. Mrs. Alice Felton of Green River gives $1. Josephine M. Bryce of Wheatland gives $5. The Jackson Hole Business and Professional Women's Club contributes $219.63. Green River High School gives 25 cents.
It's moving.
The statue's installed in D.C. in 1960. Then a replica is commissioned to put in front of the Capitol back home, too. But the senator's mocking of the statue hints at how the narrative around Esther is starting to change by the 1950s. By the time of the vote, she's starting to lose her prominence in Wyoming's story. Jennifer Helton, a historian, says that's thanks to one man.
So we have to talk about T.A. Larson.
In 1938, the University of Wyoming hires T.A. Larson to join the history department. A decade in, he's the head of the department. And in the 1950s, right around the time the Esther statue is proposed, he starts to challenge her importance.
And if you go look up newspaper articles from the time, it's pretty clear that T.A. Larson does not think that Esther Morris should get a statue.
T.A. Larson has a lot of beef with Esther. Remember the Tea Party story? How Esther gathered all the important men in South Pass City and lobbied them to pass suffrage? T.A. Larson says the Tea Party never happened. He rejects the idea that Esther was actively agitating for suffrage.
He just seems to be stuck on this idea that it's ridiculous that women might have had something to do with their own enfranchisement.
It's not just that T.A. Larson downplays Esther's role in suffrage. He says suffrage altogether wasn't a game changer.
He says, you know, women's suffrage didn't really make any impact in Wyoming because, sure, they elected a few women to the school board, but otherwise it was, you know, men still ran everything and, you know, didn't really make a difference, right? So he really kind of minimizes the significance.
And people listen, because T.A. Larson is kind of a big deal. In 1965, he publishes a seminal history of Wyoming. He becomes known as Mr. Wyoming and educates generations of Wyomingites with his takes.
He really kind of shaped the narrative, both publicly and within the academy as well.
And little by little, this idea that suffrage is at the center of Wyoming's story, it recedes. Today, most people know Wyoming as the cowboy state, not the equality state. Helton says this evolution happens in the context of larger political forces in the country. Second wave feminism is happening, the civil rights movement, Vietnam protests.
Women's equality was associated in some ways with, you know, we don't want to get too close perhaps to some of these more radical interpretations of things happening today.
That conservatism also probably had an effect on what the statue actually looked like. Esther was 6 feet tall, kind of severe looking, squarish in shape. Not an attractive woman, people kept telling me. But the statue is hyper feminine, almost willowy.
Maybe the details of what the actual woman Esther Morris looked like are less important to the people who are embracing these monuments than is a general idea of here's what a woman ought to look like.
This is Cynthia Culver Prescott. She's a historian at the University of North Dakota. Prescott studies early monuments to what she calls pioneer mothers.
A white woman in a sunbonnet, either striding westward on the trail or seated, resting from her labors later in life, are the two sort of standard images.
Many of these monuments to unnamed frontierswomen were put up in the 1910s and 1920s. And the women they depict are full of symbols.
Typically surrounded by children, emphasizing her nurturing role, and also this portrayal of this white woman as being an embodiment of white civilization. That with the coming of white women, you have Christianity, you have book learning, and all of these things are seen as being sort of part of the trappings of white society arriving, the implication being displacing indigenous cultures in the region.
The most prolific sculptor of pioneer mothers was Avard Fairbanks, the same artist commissioned to make Esther. Prescott has documented about 200 of these sculptures by Fairbanks and others, all with similar tropes.
These pioneer mother monuments are a way to kind of instruct the next generation in what a true woman really looks like, what a true woman should act like.
Statues of women can be complicated even today. Remember those four sisters in the Wyoming Capitol? Truth, justice, courage, and hope. Toni Ross, the retired senator, says the artist's initial build of the statues was a little too risque for a government building.
There was a debate over their clothing as to whether or not it was too revealing.
The artist, De La Salle, had to add heavier draping. Also,
there were issues raised by several different legislators as to the size of the women's nipples. And so we had to have De La Salle knock them down a little bit. It's a true story.
The allegorical woman is a beautiful, sexualized woman. But the real woman couldn't be herself either. The statue of Esther represents a woman who accomplished real things and wielded power. But by making her form more traditionally feminine, her sculptor also refused to see her fully. The statue ignored that Esther Hobart Morris consistently defied other people's ideas of her and what her life should look like. And it turns out, it's not the only monument to this woman that didn't get the facts right. Back in South Pass City, site superintendent Joe Ellis strolls down the main street until he reaches one of the rebuilt historic cabins. Out front stands a stone marker.
Home and office site of Esther Hobart Morris, and it's in the wrong spot.
This spot is actually where her son's newspaper office stood. When the curators realized the marker was in the wrong spot, they put up a metal text panel explaining that. Ella says he's not sure why this happened. The site had the town's maps with land ownership labeled all along. But he sees it as a symptom of a larger injustice. That the story of Esther hasn't been fully explored or told in South Pass City. That she hasn't been given her due.
For the equality state, and that was became our motto, and it became something that we built monuments in the wrong spot for.
On the spot where Esther actually lived, now stands a section of the site's sewer system. Something about the optics, putting sewer lines near her home, or more recently, placing her in the Capitol basement, even though it's a really, really nice basement, rubs Ellis the wrong way.
The placement is... It's important because it was that first impression of the Capitol building. Here's the sculpture of this woman that represents a major portion of our history. And yeah, it probably is a better place in the basement in terms of preserving the statue and also giving it an opportunity to build more programs around. But it's also that statement of, you know, this is front and center is important to people. And there's a lot of people that miss her at that location.
I meet Peg Osland at Esther's old spot in front of the Capitol on a blustery August morning. She shows up wearing a suffragette white blazer, a colorful stone butterfly brooch affixed to the lapel.
Yeah. I'm kind of emotional about this.
She's emotional because Esther has been gone from her place in front of the Capitol for so long. In 2019, Oslin, along with her mother and some friends, started a campaign to get Esther back outside. Her mom, Mary, passed away in 2021.
I really fight for this statue, for the generation before me. My mom and then my grandmother. These are real frontier women.
Oslin says her mother grew up poor in Mount Vernon, New York. She trained as a nurse, met her husband in the hospital.
Then he brought her to Wyoming, where she couldn't even get a job as a nurse. Started having children.
She had 8. Oslin's the oldest. Meanwhile, Oslin's father was elected to the state senate, ran for governor, and helped set the stage for the development of Wyoming's coal fields, the biggest in the world. Mary Oslin often stayed in the background.
She took a back seat a lot of times as the wife, but as she got older and then in her widowed years, she really became much more outspoken of her own views.
One of the things she became adamant about later in life was putting Esther back in front of the Capitol. What, I wonder, did the Esther monument say to Mary Osland and women like her? What about her absence? Historian Cynthia Culver Prescott says the monuments we see, or don't, have a subconscious effect.
If you're a woman and realize there aren't any statues of women, or if you are a person of color and you don't see any statues that look like you, then that has a psychological impact that's not easy to measure about what's important, what's powerful in our society.
Lindsay Linton Buck has spent a lot of time thinking about this type of subconscious messaging in Wyoming. She's a photographer who lives in Jackson.
We are the cowboy state. That kind of more patriarchal imagery is still very strong.
In 2015, she started a project called Women in Wyoming, photographing and interviewing Wyoming women.
I wanted to show and highlight stories that you haven't necessarily heard of or that you necessarily think about when you think about Wyoming.
She photographed a cowgirl, a wildlife biologist, a choreographer.
Completely different career paths.
An abstract painter, a writer, the state's first female Supreme Court justice, Wyoming's first Native American senator.
I think at the root, it was my experience of growing up in Wyoming and never imagining a future for myself here and wanting to create something that girls growing up in the state could see those pictures of themselves. Seeing is believing, and it's so powerful to see a reflection of yourself out in the world. And then as I continued to move along, it was you know, wanting to create something that adds to the cultural history of Wyoming, of American history, and then, you know, tie back to this pioneering history that we do have as a state that kind of got lost for a lot of years.
The project features 25 people, kind of iconography of the women of contemporary Wyoming. They're photographed in their work clothes, on the land, in their element. There's a Wyomingness about the images as a set. Animals and landscape ever present, hair windswept, satisfied grins. But the portraits offer individual stories.
When you can see a representation of yourself, that opens your imagination. It expands your mind. It expands your perception of what is possible. That is everything, right? That is how we keep moving forward. That is how we keep stretching ourselves.
Back at the Capitol, Peg Ostlin marches across the empty spread of concrete where Esther once stood, up the Capitol steps, down the checkered marble hall, descends a set of stairs, walks around the corner, then another set of stairs, into the underground connector, through to its terminus, to Esther's current perch.
Look at that face.
Esther holds her head high, and there's forward movement in the bronze, as if she's defiantly striding into the future. The pedestal is gone, but her bigness is still imposing. Ostlin keeps gazing up at her, eyes shiny, like she's got a crush on her.
That's a humbling statue. She helped bring Wyoming into being. And it's a quiet satisfaction of a job well done.
The statues move, and Ostlin's campaign got a lot of media attention and some sympathetic allies in government. But in the spring of 2023, legislators affirm their decision to keep Esther in the basement connector. There are rumors that someone will introduce another bill to move her back outside.
She's so needed now, and by men and women.
But Esther can't do it alone, right? Can't be a lone voice for women, for broader equality. I imagine she'd want some sisters in bronze, with their own stories, dotting the prairie, even in the Wyoming elements. Who might they be? Wyoming boys and girls in some not-too-distant future. Might they pause on a walk, raise a hand against the sun and sharp wind, and look up at some new statue, reading her face?
This episode was written and produced by Irina Zhuroff. She is the author of the new novel, Lost Believers. Special thanks to musician John Myenzinski for sharing recordings of his piano music. Voice acting and archival readings in this episode from Robin Lynn and Tommy Bazarian. Thanks also to Jennifer Helton, Peg Ostlin, Joe Ellis, Wyoming PBS, and the American Heritage Center for providing archival materials. Thanks also to Renee Lagrid and Wendy Mattson. The senior editor for Monumental is Rosalind Tordesillas, and our senior producer is Nancy Rosenbaum. Jamie York is our writer, and our production assistant is Perry Gregory. The show is recorded by Bryce Bowman and Ben Erickson at Earshot Audio Post and mixed by Tommy Bazarian, with support from Emmanuel Desarme, Pedro Rafael Rosado, Morgan Flannery, and Sandra Lopez Monsalve. Fact-checking by Christina Ribello. Our theme was composed and produced by Jelani Bowman, with additional music by Alexis Quadrado. Edwin Ochoa is our project manager, and our executive producer is Jocelyn Gonzalez. Monumental is produced by PRX Productions and made possible by a grant from the Mellon Foundation. For more on the show, visit us at prx.org/monumental. I'm Ashley C. Ford. Thanks for listening.
Hello, I'm Cece Winans. When the United Negro College Fund was founded 80 years ago, they hoped they would change this nation for the better, and they had. Since 1944, UNCF has helped to make college dreams a reality for more than 500,000 students, creating countless leaders and change makers. 8 decades of empowering and supporting students on their journeys to higher education. Please visit uncf.org today and help us create a world where education knows no boundaries.
Welcome to WHFR. My name is The Diva, and my show is on Saturdays from 5 to 8 p.m. It's called Lyrical Infusion with The Diva, but I'm nothing without you. Why don't you make a date with The Diva and come let me play just for you. Saturdays, 5 to 8 p.m., Lyrical Infusion with The Diva and you. 89.3 WHFR.FM.
Broadcasting from the campus of Henry Ford College, this is WHFR Dearborn, listener-supported, non-commercial radio.
Sounds wonderful. For tickets, more information, and anything you'd like to know about Dearborn Symphony, go to DearbornSymphony.org.